So I think actually, Danny, in the 2.5 year history of Dunked On Now, this is the longest we've ever gone without recording an episode. It's pretty close to that. I think the second longest was last year during Sports Business Classroom as well, because it's a pretty intensive program. So really enjoyed doing that. Met some amazing students. It was an honor to be their professor, so to speak. Awesome time once again this year. Exhausting, however, you can probably hear it in my voice actually. But nevertheless, we shall soldier on here. We're sponsored today by MeUndies. Go to MeUndies.com/capspace to get 20% off your first pair plus free shipping at MeUndies.com/capspace. So I think where I want to start here is with changes to, you know, the actual game of basketball itself. We've been so transaction focused here, but are these welcome changes for you, Danny?
Broadly speaking, yes. So while we were in Vegas, though, I don't think either of us went to the press conference, the NBA's Board of Governors met and enacted a couple of different reforms. Just because it's a quicker conversation, let's start with the trade deadline. So they moved the trade deadline from after the All-Star game to from the Thursday after the All-Star game to the Thursday 10 days before the All-Star game. Why the trade deadline has to be on a Thursday, I don't exactly know, but it is, and it is. I am of a couple of different minds about this.
Which two are those?
So I understand the reasoning behind it, especially after DeMarcus Cousins last year, the drama of which I actually missed because I was on that cruise in the Caribbean, but the awkwardness of him being asked about trades constantly and then it actually happening basically during All-Star weekend.
Got told in his ear that it had happened like while he was giving an interview.
I believe that is correct. Yeah. So I understand that it is the sort of impetus to make a change like that. However, I think that's a little bit too early. What I would have done is made it the first day after the last games before the All-Star game, because really, if it happens before that, there isn't any real media availability that day. Then teams get a little bit of time to talk. Also, assuming they're keeping the March 1st, kind of end of February, March 1st waiver deadline, it really does open up some stuff there for players to figure out what their market is going to be before the waiver deadline.
I don't like it at all. A couple of reasons. Although actually, no, I should say there is one reason I like it, which is now I can basically just get a full week of vacation during the All-Star game, which I don't care about at all. But aside from that, since I can actually be a little bit more altruistic, I think we're going to see fewer trades because teams, the longer you go in the season, the more clear it is what your destiny is for that season. So if teams can delude themselves that they're still in it, then they're not going to want to trade their guys. Oh, we're going to go for it. I mean, think of the Hawks last year, for example, right? I don't think that would have been affected by having a change of 2 weeks or so. But still, I think for a lot of these teams, even, you know, a hot week or two can kind of keep them in it, or a bad week or two can make them think, all right, you know, we it's time to give up on this season. So that's one.
I'll add there is that this season in particular, that could be true just because of how it looks like these things are breaking out. I've been thinking a little bit about tiers already, thinking about doing that for Real Jam Radio this upcoming week. And there are a lot of teams that will at least start the season thinking of themselves as contenders. And one of the hardest things for a GM and or owner to do is to make the decision that they're not. And so
especially in the East, you can really delude yourself into thinking that, hey, you know, we could be,
we can get to 40, we can get to 38.
Yeah, or even we could get to 50 as well. I mean, but again, I think that Hawks situation last year, we noted that no one really who was in position to be like a 5 seed that we could recall had ever traded someone like Millsap, and it ended up being the wrong decision not to trade him. They let him go. They kind of shifted gears, it seemed like, once Travis Schlenk came in. But I think the other aspect of it is I didn't really see a problem with how it was before. And I think that having a period where there aren't any games of about a week leading up to the trade deadline isn't really good for the league. The All-Star break has, of course, been extended. But because the trade deadline was there, now people were talking about the NBA all during that time period. And now they're just going to kind of go chill out, right? Like me, I mean, I talk about the NBA for a living and now I don't have to be around. So I think that the having it be while there are games going on, you can use the games to be the story then. And then you can have this period with no games to be about the trade deadline.
Yeah, I think that's certainly a fair point, but we can move on to the more substantive changes, which were more about pace of play than anything
else. Yeah, remember when you're like, oh, we can hit this one pretty quickly?
I was so wrong. I am often wrong. We love process stuff, but the timeouts.
I can't help myself. I'm losing my voice and I still can't stop talking. It's terrible.
So with the timeouts, there are a series of different adjustments. One is that now they've eliminated what were quote unquote 20-second timeouts, which were kind of BS because they were actually 60. Now everything is 75, all team timeouts. And
yeah, so those are the ones that are not like commercial timeouts, basically, right? Correct. Like if they call an extra timeout and they wouldn't normally go to commercial, they probably will go to like one commercial, but it's not going to be one of these like, you know, 3 minute long commercial breaks.
Right. So that adjustment is in there, but they're also dropping the under 9 timeout in the second and fourth quarters. So there are only 2 mandatory timeouts per quarter.
And the point was made that this isn't going to really decrease the length of games at all, because I think they're going to make up for those commercials by just making the breaks a little bit longer. I'm good with this though, because that under 9 timeout was so miserable, especially because, and it also even allowed teams who didn't have as much depth, especially in the playoffs, to say, oh, we're going to rest this guy for 3 minutes, but we have so much time on the end of the quarter, and then that under 9 timeout. And we'd see even teams with bad benches in the playoffs, like couldn't even make it to the under 9 timeout. They still have to call timeout. They couldn't even make it 3 minutes. But nonetheless, I think that just, it makes it so choppy. And so now instead, they're going to change it up. So the first stoppage will be under 7, and then the next one will remain at under 3. I like that too, because at the start of the first and third, you would get some really long periods of time where guys would get pretty exhausted at the start of the game, and you'd have this super long period. Yeah, you can get into the game, but then it was basically every 3 minutes after that, you would have a timeout. And so now we don't have to deal with that quite as much, which I think is a good thing.
And then the other big one, at least for me, is that now each team only has 2 timeouts in the final 2 minutes of a game.
Yeah, and it used to be 3.
Mm-hmm.
And David Locke made a point, which I thought was a good one, that basically means each team is only going to have 1 timeout in the last 2 minutes, because you got to save one in theory for advancing the ball if you're close. And I think that's good. I was never one who actually complained that much about the end of games, except for replay reviews. It was the only thing that I felt slowed it down. I think those are important to have late in the game. But for me, I didn't mind it because I could just check Twitter. I felt like the drama would sort of build, actually, if there was more of a break. While it can be extremely exciting to go back and forth with no timeouts in the last 30 seconds of the game, I kind of actually enjoy the chance for the drama to build. Like, oh my God, this guy scored. This could be an unbelievable shot that won it. Okay, what are they going to run? Are they going to sub in offense, defense? Are you going to advance the ball? What's the strategy here? Do they need to foul? How much time do they have? All of those kinds of things. I actually sort of enjoy that. It makes that end of the game, each moment is a little bit more pregnant than, okay, wow, that was just an enormous shot that you just hit. And then 3 seconds later, it's obscured by something else. I guess I just have more of an attention span. And also, it's a good chance to like get on Twitter and kind of, you know, get ready for it or talk about it a little bit if we're doing the Twitter NBA show. So I'm not saying that like I don't like this, but I just didn't hate the timeouts as much as everyone else seems to.
I draw a couple of different lines here. One big one for the 3 timeouts is in person versus on television. It felt long in person, getting those 3 timeouts in the end of the game. And so I agree with you on television when you have all the other stuff going on, but when you're there, there were games where it was just interminable. And that's a challenge that I think they tried to address here. And then the other part is kind of the casual versus the hardcore fan. You know, people like us can occupy that entire time. A lot of our listeners probably can as well. But when you're trying to broaden the base, and things like hashtag League Pass Alert or anything else, those are trying to bring in people who might not be as interested, who might be more interested in the quicker action and things like that. And so you're getting a little bit more into baseball territory when you have that many stoppages, especially with the replay reviews on top of it. So I think that's what they're aiming for. Whether it works or not is an open question. I would love to see them experiment with changing or abolishing live ball timeouts during certain portions of the game. That is something that I also think drags it out. But those sorts of conversations will need to happen in a different setting at a different time.
Yeah, also another change, each team will have 2 timeouts per overtime period. Previously, teams would get 3. And I've actually always thought that overtime was too long. I felt that it should be 3 minutes, because a lot of these overtimes, there's enough time where there's separation. It's not close again at the end. Maybe the point of that is for that very purpose. They don't want to go into double overtime. But if you only made overtime 3 minutes, then if it goes into double overtime, it's only 6 minutes of actual playing time. It's going to take longer due to all the timeouts and stuff. But I always felt like those first couple of minutes of overtime, you just came from such a drama-packed portion of the game. And then it's like, oh, it's not really, these first 2 minutes is like not as important again. Whereas if you started it with 3 minutes, it's like, all right, you're just maintaining that tension throughout the entire time. Anyway, that's ancillary to what we're talking about here.
But then there's one other thing that I want to talk about, which is probably going to be a parlor game for the two of us, which is the rule that halftime is only 15 minutes for all games now, beginning when the second quarter stops. I want to see if they actually enforce this. They say there's going to be a delay of a game penalty, jersey retirements, numerous other things. Like, they've tried to make it a hard rule, but we'll have to see.
Yeah, I can't wait to hang out with you as you gleefully start a timer the moment the buzzer expires in the first half to see whether this works out. I can't wait. That's going to be incredible. A couple other really small things we don't need to comment on further. It is now a delay of game violation if a free throw shooter ventures beyond the 3-point line between attempts. You only have 10 seconds after you get the ball, but that would sort of slow things down before the guy even got the ball. And you mentioned the thing about halftime. What are the effects of some of these changes? I think one of them is that it's going to be harder now to play big minutes, because with fewer timeouts, now you're not getting as many chances to recover. And also worth noting, one of the things that we talked about many times is how much harder the game is today from a physical standpoint. There are so many fewer free throws these days. And that even provides less of a chance for players to really recover in game as well. Now, part of that will be mitigated by the fact that some of the breaks will be a little bit longer, but that's not something that I really think is going to be conducive to guys playing a ton of minutes. Maybe it'll have more of an effect even perhaps in the playoffs. And although the one thing you could also add is that maybe there's been some research I'm aware of, I'm not that up on it, but it's been alluded to this idea that if you kind of completely empty the tank early in games, that like you can't recover. Whereas like if you just three-quarter empty the tank, then it's easier to recover. And so maybe just shortening from 6 to 5 minutes, that period at the start of the first and third quarters, maybe that'll help players maintain energy. But it'll be interesting to see whether teams adjust their strategy at all based on this. And I think it might give the altitude teams a little bit more of an advantage.
It very well could. And also, we'll see if this has any impact in terms of teams using those extra roster spots now, the 16th and 17th, which are two-way contracts. We've been seeing more of those being announced, and just dealing with active roster spots a little bit differently, just because you might actually need those 12th and 13th players more frequently than before.
All right, we still have to catch up on all the signings that we've had so far in the last 6 days or so, update you who's left in the market, who still has space. But first, this from MeUndies, the softest, most comfortable you will ever wear, period. Of course, all the students at SBC, the first joke out of their mouths, yeah, really funny guys, was, oh, are you wearing MeUndies right now? And I let them know that yes, in fact, I was quite comfortable in the Las Vegas heat, I might add. And the reason is each pair of MeUndies is sustainably sourced and made from micromodal fabric, 3 times softer than cotton. They come in all kinds of colors and patterns, and they release new limited edition patterns each month that always sell out. They've actually sent me some pretty wild stuff, in addition to, of course, having stuff that's a little bit more basic. This month's patterns were designed by the legendary 80s clothing brand Cross Colors. Oh, actually, I remember that. A lot of people wore that. I'd think of Cross Colors is actually more of a 90s brand for me. But in any event, the names live up to their bold design and bright colors. Increase the piece, you dig, and the OG. Got to see them for yourself at MeUndies.com/capspace. That's your URL to get 20% off your first pair and free shipping only at MeUndies.com/capspace. There's a reason they've sold over 5 million pairs to date. And if you don't love your first pair of MeUndies, you don't agree with me that they're the most comfortable underwear that you'll ever wear. They're free. Once again, 20% off your first pair, free shipping, MeUndies.com/capspace is that URL, MeUndies.com/capspace. All right, where do you want to start here? I enjoy you taking us through these magical mystery tours of some of these free agent signings.
I want to start with the San Antonio Spurs. The Spurs, first of all, almost immediately after we released our last podcast and I snarked that Joffrey Laverne was going to be looking for a job outside of North America, he got a contract with the San Antonio Spurs. So we don't know the exact terms of that yet still, but that's one of those things that'll probably come out over the next few days. But they signed him, and the more important news which was pretty dumbfounding to me at the time, and to a point still is, was that they rescinded on the last day, they rescinded the qualifying offer to free agent guard Jonathan Simmons.
And one quick bit of cap minutia here. You've heard it misreported at times that a restricted free agent has been renounced. You can renounce a restricted free agent, but the difference between rescinding a qualifying offer where now you no longer have that 1 year contract out to him that makes him a restricted free agent and renouncing him, which means now you're letting go of his cap hold so that you can't pay him with bird rights. Those are two different things. So Simmons was not renounced, but he did have his qualifying offer rescinded. And that meant that he could negotiate anywhere. And I theorized that the reason at the time we talked about this on our cap dork thread, everyone was like, why did they do this? And I felt the Spurs are just so culture focused, it seemed, that Simmons, who I think chafed at, despite the fact that the Spurs kind of brought him into the world as an NBA player, he chafed at having to not play as much behind players that I, and likely he, because players are even more focused on these things than I am, he chafed a little bit at having to be behind inferior players like Kyle Anderson. And he probably felt, hey, you know, I've got this market that would be there if I weren't a restricted free agent right now. And the Spurs were like, well, I don't know if we want to bring this guy back at a reduced number. If, all right, we can leverage him and force him to take this and make him come back and have him be unhappy and be a negative influence. That maybe to the Spurs is just like, well, we've already lost this guy anyway. And they also maybe just think that he's not that important. That could be another thing. But so I think what they hoped was, all right, maybe we can salvage this if we pull his qualifying offer and then let him go out on the market, see what else is there. And if he finds out that, in fact, our offer was competitive, maybe he'll come back. That's not what ended up happening. He signed it with the Magic, and there were dueling reports about whether he was still negotiating with the Spurs or not. Shams, when he signed, said no, there weren't any further negotiations. So maybe that was all subterfuge with the Spurs, and they just wanted him gone. Didn't want his what they perceived as an attitude problem. I mean, what do you think all that, Danny?
I think it's certainly a possibility. I also completely would understand Simmons chafing not only at the playing time issue, but also being a 27-year-old restricted free agent really changes your perspective on this whole thing. And Simmons famously had to pay to try out for the Spurs. So you think about just kind of where he had gone in his career.
Yeah, the Austin Spurs.
The Austin Spurs. That was really his one shot at making life-changing money. And by being a restricted free agent by a team that may not have shown a ton of interest in bringing him back. Because, I mean, if he had been unrestricted from day one, I feel like he would have gotten a lot more money than the 3 years, $18 million, but only partially guaranteed in the third year that he ended up getting from the Magic. So I can see all of that. But I can't have a guarantee of it. I have not talked to anybody in their front office. So I think that's a reasonable interpretation, but far from the only one. But whatever happened, now he is a member of the Magic on what I consider an exceedingly reasonable contract that was even better. I mean, it was originally reported as 320, then it was 318, then it was 318 with $1 million guaranteed in the final season. And Simmons is far from a perfect player. He was not what made the Spurs run, but he was a talented wing defender in a league without talented wing defenders, and he was athletic. I thought he could still improve, even if his jump shot was not great, and I thought one of the best runs he had was in the Western Conference Finals, what immediately preceded his restricted free agency.
Yeah, and obviously he played well in that Houston series also, and I thought he was one of their five best players against the Warriors, and they've added Rudy Gay. Maybe that would have supplanted him, but for Simmons, I think it makes sense too, because in Orlando you can say that he has a more defined role, perhaps that he can really be their main defender on the wing if Aaron Gordon is going to be playing the four, and he doesn't quite have the size to guard some of the bigger threes, but then maybe they can put Gordon on those guys. And you said you liked the contract. I think so too. Much depends on his ability to hit the three-pointer, but he is solid getting to the basket. He also probably shot unsustainably well from mid-range on some pretty difficult contested attempts during the playoffs. So I wouldn't expect to get that player that we saw in the playoffs, despite the fact that you and I have both always been fans of him and felt like he should play more than he did. So now we'll see what happens. I mean, there are guys who leave San Antonio and are still pretty good. There are guys who leave San Antonio and we're kind of never hear from them again, while we're on it, what else is going on with the Orlando Magic?
Oh, well, so actually I wanted to say one other thing on the Spurs before we move on, which is that one of the other angles of this is that they're trying to maintain their 2018 cap space, something that we talked about a lot in their offseason preview, and that is certainly possible. I want to see what happens with Pau Gasol's contract, because now it looks like he's going to be taking, because they're functioning over the cap and everything like that, and they're actually hard cap because of the Rudy Gay mid-level extension deal. So I want to see how much money he gets, and also if there is a 2018-19 component to it, because that would affect their flexibility moving forward as well. And of course, Rudy Gay coming back from an Achilles injury, possibility he picks up his player option, throws us all into whack. They could still get plenty of space, but it might be less than some think. But that could have played a factor in all this if they're kind of like, well, we're not really sure with the value, and it makes this harder.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see with Gasol. I think they can. He was due a little over $16 million this year initially. And how much room do they have left under the hard cap now?
Let me pull it up. So I have it that they, including Patty Mills' deal, I have it that they have about $23 million before the tax. So that would mean $29 million before the apron. But they also have to pay LaVerne, probably David Lee, Brandon Paul, who was announced they signed that we don't have terms yet, who is a summer league standout, and then Manu and Pau, assuming Manu comes back.
Yeah, so they could give Pau pretty close to what he had before, I think, and not be in any trouble, I think, with the apron. They'd still have enough room to work there and then get him off the books, and that's certainly the way I would advocate them handling that situation.
Sure. So let's finish up with the Magic. They waived CJ Watson, who was guaranteed $1 million of a $5 million salary. That's not a surprise. His guarantee date was coming up. And they may have signed Kem Birch, who was a talented prospect years ago and then went and played in Europe. He was actually in Greece last year. I haven't heard much about that since it was kind of reported a couple of smaller places, but we'll have to keep an eye on it.
Yeah, Birch, a mobile, skinny center, good dive man on the pick and roll, someone that I actually think a player type that the Magic could use. We'll see what ends up happening. I mean, they still have Biombo, they still have Nikola Vucevic, so not a guy who will play a lot, but maybe he wants to be back. Quick one here in OKC, Nick Collison returns to Oklahoma City on a one-year deal. Collison was probably given more than he was worth over his last deal, which was a little over $3 million. He's not going to play at all this season, but I'm guessing he probably didn't have much interest on the market. And we could say what we want to about, oh, you know, they need to develop these guys and get more of a developmental spot on the roster. But OKC has enough young guys. I think it's fine to bring back Collison, especially because what they're really trying to do this year is use their culture to sell Paul George, and Collison, of course, well known to be a big part of that.
Yeah, he made the transition from Seattle to Oklahoma City with the team. Let's go to Jonathan Simmons' former teammate and now also former Spur, Dwayne Dedmon. Dedmon had been languishing on the open market, ended up getting a life raft in Atlanta from the Hawks, gave him 2 years, $14 million, player option for the second year, so probably something like 7-7. That's a pretty reasonable kind of situation, sort of the player-friendly version of what Amir Johnson and Jonas Rebko got from the Celtics recently, and I think that's a fair wage for him, though I wonder a little bit where Atlanta is going with everything.
Yeah, especially because there's no upside with the player option. I would guess as of now that he probably would end up opting in there, but the Hawks needed some more at center. I think he will probably start for them, I would imagine. They only had Plumlee and Diamond Stone. John Collins also has looked very solid in some way. And actually, no, I shouldn't say that, because they also have Mescal, so they're going to have a pretty damn crowded
and Miles Plumlee
center rotation. Yeah, I think I mentioned him, but it's... Yeah.
Oh, I forgot to mention it just because I have to, that Jonathan Simmons is going to make less than DJ Augustine for all 3 years of that contract, which is astonishing, but I just had to mention that.
Yeah, summer of 2016, man.
Not a calibrator for anything, but another piece of Atlanta's
remarkable. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Another piece of Atlanta's front court rotation was that they re-signed Ersan Ilyasova. So Ilyasova has bounced around immensely on his last contract and then ended up last season with the Hawks, re-signed with them 1 year, $6 million. Not a bad deal, but not necessarily a deal that the Hawks should make. I was a little bit dumbfounded by the combination of these, just because you're throwing $13 million in this year's cap to players who are good, but provide zero long-term value for you in a year when A, you're not going to be good, and B, cap space is incredibly valuable. And they prove that by getting a first round pick for basically taking on about $14 million from Jamal Crawford after the buyout.
Yeah, that buyout has reduced things a little bit for him. The Hawks about out of space now, depending on when they sign Muscala. I'm not sure if they've officially signed him yet. He had a cap hold for the minimum. They could take on about another $7 million or so, but once they sign him, I think they'll be pretty darn close to out of space. Maybe they'll have room to sign a few guys to longer contracts before they hit the cap. Still have their room exception available as well, but that's only 2 years. They want to maintain a little bit of cap space for maybe some second rounders, undrafted guys. And Ilyasova, again, I mean, Deadman, who has always been liked by the Golden State organization, and Travis Schlenk now, of course, is there. So you see the connection, but it doesn't really seem like, you know, are they trying to tank me? I'd love to see what Diamond Stone and John Collins can do. They're Deadman and Ilyasova, you know, quality players. And so maybe the Hawks are inching closer to kind of getting 35 wins this year. They have no high end talent on this team whatsoever. You'd be, I don't think they have a single player on this team who's even in the top 20 at their position right now, which is pretty incredible to say. But they do have a lot of depth, and we'll see what happens with Mike Budenholzer. Can get a lot out of his bench at times.
Well, and it's something I wanted to mention is that if Travis Schlenk has the autonomy it sounds like he has, something else that could be an option here is that something you mentioned about the George Hill contract, which is that it's going to be hard for teams to just sometimes take players into space, or maybe the trading team might not be as interested. Maybe it's not about immediate money, it's about long-term money. Ersan Ilyasova and Deadman at those prices, if they're trying to move them in early February, they'll look pretty good. So if they want to take on long-term money and say, hey, we're not going to leave you without a canoe, we can give you Deadman, something like that. Like, that might have substantially more interest to a team like the Blazers, where, yeah, I mean, obviously it'd be better to get to lower their tax burden this year, but they're also trying to make the playoffs. So a situation like that could actually work out.
Yeah, that's an excellent point there. And I think, and you know, if they trade those guys at the deadline, Ersan Ilyasova might get traded. That's an interesting thought there. It doesn't happen very often, but I think we'll see. They can still kind of tank plenty from that point on, you would think. So, I think in a vacuum, these are totally fine contracts. These are decent players. It's just I'm a little bit worried about winning too many games, but we'll see. And you mentioned Crawford. He took about a $3 million haircut off of the $17.5 million that he was owed, essentially. That's what it is.
I believe that's what I saw, yeah. $3 to $4 million is what's in my head. But I didn't take specific notes. I think it was Vivimore that had it.
So let's get to Cleveland now, signing Chetty Osmond, a guy that we've been talking about for a long time, 31st pick in the 2015 draft. You'll recall that they actually traded the pick that became Tyus Jones to get him, and number 36, Rakeem Christmas, who was waived by the Pacers. But Osmond is here now. He had a reported buyout that made it required, really, financially, for him to sign this three-year $8.3 million deal. Osmond, I've likened him before to a worse shooting two-guard version of Mike Dunleavy. Skinny, but has the ability to get into the lane, pass, pretty decent finisher, likes to get out in transition. Much of his value will be determined by his ability to hit the three-point shot, which has vacillated quite a bit over his EuroLeague and Turkish career. And I'm not sure that he can help them against the best teams this year. He can, I think, eat up some minutes, and getting another guy who can pass and move the ball on offense, and he can get into the passing lanes for steals, but he's going to be too thin to really hold up defensively against some of the best teams, I fear. So this is yet another kind of all offense guy for the Cavs. I mean, he's a good resource. I think they got him on a decent deal. He'll be restricted at the end of those 3 years, but the price sure was steep in terms of the repeater tax.
And that is very present for Dan Gilbert. So this used a part of their taxpayer mid-level exception, because for a second round pick, there isn't a rookie scale that you can fall back on. And this combined with Jeff Green, I think that's probably their wing rotation now is probably pretty close to set. And that ties in with something that I thought was a missed opportunity for them, maybe because they don't have a general manager, which was Luke Richard and Mbah Mute taking the minimum with the Rockets. Mbah Mute on the Rockets is...
I'd rather have him than Jeff Green, that's for
absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely. And they took the same contract. I know LeBron has a relationship with Jeff Green. He's the guy who gave him the moniker Uncle Jeff. But like Dwight Howard in Orlando years ago, there's a reason why players aren't necessarily the GMs there. Mbah Mute would have given them more defensive versatility. Not, again, like Jonathan Simmons, not a perfect player, but somebody who could provide value. And that's why I think he really will help the Rockets.
Yeah, and I think that the Rockets' approach to filling out their team as opposed to Cleveland's is a very interesting contrast. The Rockets going for more defense, Tucker, because they feel like, hey, you know what? We've got all these awesome offensive players. What we really need more of is defense. So they got Tucker, they got Luke, and now they can actually put a lineup on the floor against the Golden State Warriors where they don't really have many defensive liabilities other than maybe James Harden. And the Cavaliers can't do that. You know, they spent their resources on Green, who looks like he can play defense, but doesn't really. Kyle Korver, probably very difficult to play against the Warriors defensively. And so it's really, and I think the main players for Cleveland other than LeBron are defensive liabilities, unlike Houston. So I think that Houston is getting undervalued guys who can defend, and Cleveland not doing that. I like Houston's approach better when you're talking about having to beat Golden State.
I agree with you. And then the other move for Houston we should talk about is they signed Tarik Black, who had been waived by the Lakers. He had a non-guaranteed contract at about $6.5 million. And he signed reportedly for 1 year at the biannual exception. That's about $3.3 million. He will be probably their third center, maybe their fourth center, but a nice fit. You know, somebody who can eat up regular season minutes. I don't expect him to play once they get to the playoffs, and they'll be going smaller more often. But you need that sort of depth in the regular season.
Yeah, especially when Nene is your backup center. And Black, a guy I thought was undervalued. I think this is a solid price for Houston. You'll recall that Houston basically found him. That's where he started his career. He's got some good mobility, plays hard, runs the floor hard, can get on the offensive glass, limited offensively to really finishing dunks around the rim, but that's just fine. They got plenty of other guys who can score on this team.
We can go back out to the Eastern Conference with the Celtics. They finally signed Gordon Hayward, had their whole announcement thing, and so they had to make the accompanying roster moves beyond
that was delayed, by the way, because Avery Bradley had to report to Detroit for his physical, and I believe you have a week to do that during the offseason, so that was what the delay there was.
Right. So they had to clear a little bit more space. They did so by waiving Jordan Mickey and Demetrius Jackson. I believe we're still inside Jackson's waiver window. I wouldn't be completely floored if somebody picked him up, but he had $600,000 guaranteed. So we'll see. And before the Hayward,
I didn't see a ton from him in summer league, by the way, but maybe somebody else did.
Yeah. He didn't look spectacular to me, but I mean, there are going to be worse point guards that get on NBA rosters this year. So, and in the interim, kind of before they signed Hayward, they had a little bit of cap space to squeeze out just because of the idea of getting guys on the minimum and then basically using the instead of roster holds. And so they signed Abdul Nader, who was a standout in the D League for them last year, and second round pick Semi Ojeleye, who I loved both in Utah and in Vegas. Nader was reported as a 4-year deal. Ojeleye, I saw some verbiage around that, but I haven't seen anything in terms of the specifics of the contract. If so, at the minimum, those are both spectacular deals for Boston just because that amount of team control is really beneficial, and they're not going to have a lot of flexibility moving forward. So I think that's a good use of cap space too.
Yeah, stick around for the end of Celtics games on the Twitter NBA show that are blowouts for a cornucopia of unsafe at any speed jokes with Abdel Nader. So now we'll see what happens with Boston. Boston, interestingly, a lot of people are like, oh, why didn't they get Dwayne Dedman? Like, how's he going to really get more? It turns out he made the right decision. He got $14 million guaranteed, and maybe Boston could have offered him more than 1 year, but the most they could have offered him was basically 8.5 guaranteed with their room exception that eventually went to Aaron Baines on only a 1-year deal. So Boston is ready to go here. We'll talk much more about them in the future. I mean, they're basically about done here. They'll probably, I haven't gotten news that they've signed Yabusele yet, but they still had room for him after the Bradley trade. So you imagine he will be in. He did not play in summer league after having arthroscopic surgery, I think, on his ankle. So maybe they can get one more ring chaser type there, but they're probably about done at this point.
A team that will not get any ring chasers in the near future, the Chicago Bulls. They made a decision that we're just going to have to see how it works out by staying over the cap. So they looked like they were going to have a bunch of cap space. They signed Cristiano Felicio. Then they instead used their mid-level exception on Justin Holiday, who signed that 2-year deal earlier in free agency. That means that they have a trade exception of about 15 $15 million. We'll see if they actually use it or not. That will expire a year after the Jimmy Butler trade, so basically right before the start of the league year before the league year turns over next year. And they also claimed David Nwaba, who had been waived by the Lakers in a deal we're going to talk about that originally I was actually thinking we would do first. The Lakers waived David Nwaba and the Bulls claimed him, which I think was worthwhile. It's fine. You know, he was not a great player, but they're going to be needing flyers, guys who can defend, guys who can fit in their culture. So why not?
Yeah, I mean, they really don't have anything that remotely approximates a wing defender on this roster at this point. So he may actually be able to get some time.
He might. And then they also signed another guy who I thought looked pretty good in summer league. It's Andre Blakeney, right? I was thinking of his Andre or Andrew.
Antonio Blakeney.
Antonio. All those A names. They're all the same to me. Antonio Blakeney to a two-way contract. We've already seen a series of those and we will see even more. I believe Chris Reichert on his blog is keeping track of two-way contracts, which is 2 ways in 10 days, I believe is the name of the website. You can find it pretty easily with those two terms anyway.
Yeah. And the Bulls still able to take on plenty of bad salary. They also have Nikola Mirotic out there. Casey Johnson mentioning that they're about $5 million apart in an update in the last couple of days. So with Mirotic's cap hold on the books, I mean, they could still even now create almost $25 million in room if they were to renounce him. I doubt they are going to do that. Mirotic has still been working out at the Advocate Center, their practice facility. And so they're over the cap right now by holding on to that trade exception. But if they want to just create cap space, they can do that as well. They also have the room exception available if they wanted to use that. But I suspect that they are nearly done. I have them now with Nwaba at 14 players.
Another team that is really close to done, the Detroit Pistons, made two signings during this time. I believe the renouncing of KCP had happened just before we recorded the last time. So they signed Reggie Bullock, re-signed him to a 2-year, $5 million deal. And then they brought back power forward Anthony Tolliver on a 1-year, $3.3 million deal, which is the biannual exception. The most notable thing to me about those transactions is actually that they use the biannual exception at all, because as it looks like they will be over the cap for the next few years, I thought that might be a better use of capital next year when it will be harder for them to spend on players.
What is next year? That concept exists in Detroit?
It doesn't exist in Detroit, but it exists other places. So that's a good point.
And by the way, snark aside, I don't see a problem with just using it this year. If you've identified someone that you want to use it on who you think is good, you know, I think it's fine. And
but it's also not that much more money than a minimum contract for him. And because now with the minimums rising pretty quickly for a guy who's been in the league,
that's a good point. I mean, and then he could have had a smaller cap hold next year as well if they wanted.
Right. And he would have been way cheaper for them because the difference in terms of salary for him isn't that much, but the difference in terms of payment is huge. It's almost $2 million.
Yeah, I think they felt they needed another stretch four option with the departure of Marcus Morris, although they still have, you know, because presumably now Tobias Harris will be a starter. I mean, John Luehr is really their only stretch four option, and Luehr probably is going to need to play some center now for them with the departure of Aaron Baines. Boban too slow for a lot of matchups off the bench, so they may move Luehr more to center, and they felt they probably needed a stretch four option off the bench with that being the case.
Yeah, at some point when I get bored, I'll calculate how much money they're paying their front court guys, because it's pretty impressive at this point. But you know, that's the way it works. We'll see if Reggie Bullock actually played. I thought he looked good before he got hurt, one of the many times he's gotten hurt, but I'm optimistic. And a two-year deal, I don't know what the status of that second year is. We'll have to keep an eye on that. The Dallas Mavericks,
terms of whether it's guaranteed or not.
Right.
One other note on Bullock, this is a perfect example here of the difference between revoking the qualifying offer and renouncing, right? Like they never even made him a qualifying offer, but he was still a free agent and they stayed over the cap. They still had his bird rights, and that's what they used to give him this deal. I don't think they had any other way to do that other than bird rights. And that's probably, even though he hadn't shown much, part of why they brought him back, because they really had no other way to add talent at a salary above the minimum. So he actually represented a way for them to spend more than minimum, and really the only way that was available to them by this point.
I was going to move on to the Mavericks, but we should talk about the former Piston, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. I had advocated for the Sixers to take a flyer on him just because I think he's a nice fit next to Markelle Fultz. They apparently did not step up, and the Lakers did. Lakers gave him a 1-year, $18 million deal, which puts him back out on the market next summer. They waived David Nwaba to clear that space, and I don't think there was a better way for them to spend this money. He will make them
better. This is a coup. This is a coup for sure. They don't have their draft pick this year. Why not get him? And then the other thing that's great too is if they don't get their double max guys next year, they could always just bring him back with some of that space as well, or even just use non-bird rights to give him a 120% bump and get him on a long-term deal. This is fantastic for the Lakers.
He also fits well with Lonzo Ball. I had obsessed over his fit with Fultz just because Fultz doesn't defend, but Ball has some two-guard in him size-wise, so you can do some switching there. You could also just put KCP on the harder guard to defend, and he brings something they didn't have before. And I still don't think the Lakers are going to be strong defensively. They just don't have the personnel, especially because they're playing Brook Lopez at center. And while he does certain things well, he's not exactly the most mobile guy in the world. But KCP makes them a better team in a way that makes a lot of sense. They still have their room exception, which they presumably could use to sign a backup point guard or split with multiple players.
Yeah, they've also left cap space to sign Thomas Bryan as well. They're second round pick to a contract starting at the minimum longer than 2 years as well. But let's go back to Detroit and KCP. Let's assume, I've heard rumblings to this effect, I don't know for sure, but let's say the offer was something around $16 million a year for KCP. You think Rich Paul made the right decision in not taking that?
It's going to be a very narrow market next summer, and one of the big challenges is that the most obvious team that will need a shooting guard is Philly, but Philly is going to have a series of different players that are of interest to them. The restricted market, maybe. I'm not sure they're going to want to do that dance again. But Avery Bradley, who the guy who replaced KCP, is going to be an unrestricted free agent. Maybe he's just trying to get leverage to stay in Detroit. We don't know. KCP is going to be there. But I think this is a worthwhile bet because he's making the money this year. So yeah, so really you're comparing 580 to more like 462. And I think he could get that.
Yeah, I would have turned it down if I were Rich Paul at the time. Now, I think you and I value KCP more. And part of the reason for that is if you're going to look at guys who can shoot the ball and are really, you know, he's one of the elite defenders to me, a 1-2 defender at his position. If you're going to look at guys who can do both those things, I mean, there's maybe 10 guys at the two guard position and 10 guys at the three position in the whole league who can do both those things. And I also think KCP is young enough. If he's on a real offense, he can shoot the ball better. He can create a lot of shots from downtown, shot it better from downtown. Excellent transition player. He really gets out in transition. Like, he's going to get some of those Lonzo Ball bombs in transition, protect Lonzo as well, let Lonzo take the easier matchup. I think his fit next to Ball is outstanding, and they'll have good size now in the backcourt. So I think he's worth more than $16 million a year. Yeah, I get that the market is tighter this year, but I think he's just a very good fit in a lot of places. I would be willing to pay him, you know, $18 million a year, $20 million a year, or something like that, if I were a team that had the space and trying to get better, because he's young enough to get better, right? And I think there's a lot of value, even if you say, okay, you know, there are plenty of players making $20 million a year, that's pretty close to the max, and he's not close to a lot of these guys who make the max. Well, that's not realistic because there's a finite amount of money in the system, and I certainly would rather get him for $20 million a year and say, okay, this guy doesn't get hurt, he's going to shoot the ball, he's a great defender, and now we've got this position solved for the next 4 years. We don't have to worry about it. This guy is going to be there, and he can still get better and maybe on the offensive end. So with all that being the case, I think that he's worth it. I think he's better than Otto Porter, that's for damn sure.
Also remember, I've talked about the Sixers and brought them up because I just think they're going to be a better team. But he also is a wonderful fit in Brooklyn, and he'll be 25 next year.
Well, apparently not. They apparently don't see it that way because they could have made him an offer and they didn't. So I wouldn't count on that market materializing. They decided they'd rather take on Damari Carroll's bad contract instead. But there are still some other teams out there that I think could potentially use him.
Right. And it could even be the Lakers. Who knows?
Yeah, no, and I think getting somewhere, being in the system now, on the chance that it doesn't work out for the Lakers, you know, I think a team like, I mean, it's tough though, I guess, because like Indiana has Oladipo now. I mean, he's so much better than Oladipo. Not to say that Oladipo is, you know, a great contract necessarily. I think Dallas, if Wes Matthews leaves, could be an interesting landing spot for him next to Dennis
KCP
Smith.
And Dennis Smith, pretty interesting. Two of our favorites next to each other would be fun. Yeah, there will be a few. Like, I haven't really.
Well, you know, and I guess, and The only other one, though, I mean, I'm looking at the teams that I project to have over 20 million in space next year. I mean, Philly is one too, but and maybe they just feel like, all right, we'll get them next year. They didn't want to do the gymnastics that would have been required to create the space. Or well, and also, I guess I understand that.
If they didn't need to make that commitment at this point, let's say they're assuming that the Lakers are going to be out of it because they're going to get those guys, then they can choose between Bradley and KCP potentially, and maybe they see that as being worth it, or maybe they have their sights set. Maybe they think they can get Paul George. I mean, who knows? So I can see them looking, maybe Brian Colangelo is looking at a rosier future than we are and saying, maybe we can do better than him.
Another interesting potential destination, and I guess it's not great. You know, it's tough coming up with a ton of teams there, but when he's unrestricted at the start, that will make a big difference. Sacramento, they have a ton of two guards, so I wouldn't necessarily expect them to be an option. San Antonio could be an interesting one, especially if Danny Green were to opt out, leave it in free agency. They'll have plenty of space. I mean, that fit of him next to Kawhi Leonard would be, it could be pretty devastating as well. So he'll have some options, but it's, I would have turned that down as Rich Paul, I think, at the time. And I probably would have been equally as disappointed as Rich Paul has ended up being in his market. It appears just that I think he's better than the rest of the league does. And, that we have plenty of players like that we feel that way on.
A couple of bookkeeping notes on their co-tenant in the Staples Center. The Clippers, we found out, I think Bobby Marks is the one who had this, that Teodosic's contract has a similar structure to J.R. Smith's in that it is J.R. Smith's prior contract, that it is a player option for the second year, but that player option is not fully guaranteed. So if he opts in and the Clippers don't want him, he has a partial guarantee of $2 million, so they can just cut him loose at that point. I think that makes some sense for both sides, considering he's an older free agent, but it is always interesting to see the structure.
Well, and it's interesting too, because I think they had some concerns about the hard cap, and now they're essentially paying him guaranteed $8 million for this year. And so that's a way to do that without necessarily impacting the hard cap. And then next year, they could always just not do something that would hard cap them. They were hard capped because they used they got him to sign, and then their mid-level is mostly Teodosic as well. They paid him more, so that would hard cut them as well. So yeah, the reason, by the way, that they have to do it this way, they actually set it up so that he had a guarantee date for this year of like 5 days after he signed. And the reason to do that is because the last year of a contract, if there's going to be an option on it, has to have the same structure in terms of guarantees as the previous year. There's only a 2-year contract. So if there's going to be that player option on it, then, and also be non-guaranteed, then the year before that has to be the same thing, non-guaranteed. So they just set it 5 days from when he signed it, so obviously they're not going to cut him then. He's guaranteed now, and then he'll have that July 10th or so guaranteed date for next year. That's how you do that. If you're going to go longer than a 2-year contract, it's very difficult to set that up. Rajon Rondo, it was initially reported that he would have that same type of contract. As it turned out, he did not.
Let's do a couple of quick ones just because we can. Dallas signed forward Maxi Kleber to a partially to a deal that I believe it's guaranteed for the first year and then a team option for the second year. He is from Wurzburg, which is the same city that Dirk Nowitzki is from. He will be on their team next year. I know nothing about him.
I once knew something about him. I saw him as like a 17 and 18 year old, maybe not that young. Maybe he was like 19 back at the Eurocamp in like 2012. And he's just kind of a long, skinny guy back then. Skilled power forward player. I mean, I don't expect to see much from him. It could just be a sop to Dirk. I hadn't heard anything about him as a prospect, but all right, I'm sure that was thrilling. Now we know exactly how he's going to play this year. Did you say that they waived Kyle Wilch already, the Clippers?
No, we should have mentioned that. And also, the Pacers waived George Niang, who was a second round pick out of Iowa State last year. He only had $100,000 guaranteed for this year, so they will pay that, just like they paid the $50,000 for Rakeem Christmas to clear his roster spot.
Yeah, Niang, I think, suffered an injury early in summer league, to my recollection. And
yeah, I believe so.
The hope that he would become the next Jared Dudley, apparently unfounded. As of now, what do we got next here?
Rajon Rondo. So Rondo, it was reported that he was meeting with the Lakers, and he had also met with the Pelicans. He has a, of course, pre-existing relationship with DeMarcus Cousins. They played together on the Kings 2 years ago. He will join the Pelicans on a 1-year deal. We do not know the amount. the Pelicans are in this unusual situation where they could pay him kind of a wide variety of salaries up to the part of the non-taxpayer mid-level exception, but they're also butting against the hard cap because of the luxury tax, sorry, is a better way of putting it, because of the Jrue Holiday situation. We don't think they're willing to pay the luxury tax, so we have to see what actual money he gets and the structure of it, but he makes them better. They needed more playmaking. They needed another point guard, even though they traded away
Tim Frazier, who is really their only good.
And presumably Rondo's going to make a lot more. And there have been some murmurs that they're actually thinking about playing Rondo and Holiday together a significant amount. While there are elements of that defensively that could work, the floor spacing is going to be a major problem in those circumstances, because they're probably going to play Davis and Cousins a lot, and then also some distinct non-shooter most of the time, Solomon Hill. So they're going to have to figure all this out, but at least they added talent.
The opportunity cost here, I think I saw rumblings that it'd be about $4 million for Rondo, if that turns out to be accurate. I think they could have done a little bit better here. Were there other guys who signed for less than that that you think that they could have gotten? Because in particular, they have zero healthy three men on the roster right now. Solomon Hill is a four, and Quincy Pondexter hasn't played in 2 years.
Yeah, so that's a big problem. I would have liked, even though I think of him as more of a two than a three, Gerald Henderson could have been a compelling fit for them, just another hard worker. There wasn't much on the three line this year. It just was not a real strength of the team. You know who really could have helped them? And
here we go.
If they just kept Omri Caspi's hold on the books. They ended up functioning as an over-the-cap team by virtue of re-signing Jrue Holiday, which of course they didn't know at the time, but that's what they expected. The opportunity cost was basically 10 days of Reggie Williams, and now they don't have him. And he ended up signing for the minimum. With a better team, he wouldn't have signed for the minimum there.
I talked to a few people who were defending that decision, and I was like, I'm sorry, I know you work in the NBA, but this is not defensible to me that you just like, oh, we need this roster spot right now. I mean, I get that in a vacuum, you need the roster spot, but like Reggie Williams for a 10-day, I mean, you got to be kidding me. Interesting out there still is Dante Cunningham. You'll recall that he opted out of over $3 million this year. Doesn't look like that's going to be out there for him. They have less of a need for him at this point because they've got Cousins and Davis now. They've got Solomon Hill to play backup for. Cunningham, not that great of a shooter really to play the threes, slowing down as well now at age 30. Maybe they could still bring him back, though. They could keep his cap hold on the books, maybe pay him a little bit more than the minimum. Where do you want to go next?
Let's do the Knicks. So the Knicks, their other big offseason signing after Tim Hardaway Jr. was Ron Baker, who announced that he was coming back on July 1st, but we didn't find out the terms for a long time. He ended up getting the room mid-level exception for 2 years. Do you know the structure of that, whether the second year is an option or whatever?
I believe it is a player option.
Good for him, because then, yes, he will be restricted if he opts out, but which he very well might not, because that's a lot of money for Ron Baker. But if either way, he will have a very high qualifying offer because it is built off of your prior year's salary. And as we saw with Langston Galloway and a few other guys, that really ratchets up when you're a player who actually made a lot more but was still a restricted free agent.
I mean, as of right now, and the Knicks are out of space because they use their room exception on him, he could start for them at the one if they decide Nilkina is not ready. He could be their starting one this year.
Their point guard rotation is Ron Baker and Frank Ntilikina at this moment. That is incredible.
Well, they have their draft pick this year.
That's true.
And then also, if they trade Carmelo, they're going to have like no threes on the roster either.
It's Thomas time, baby.
I mean, they'll probably just start Courtney Lee at the three is what they'll do.
Lee and Hardaway. That could very well be.
And Lee can guard a lot of guys like that. So that's maybe being a little bit unfair. But for the Knicks, this is another instance where really I think they kind of blew it. They misread the market. If they agreed to this, as Baker tweeted out, he was happy to be back, so presumably the terms of this contract had been agreed to at that time. It's just there's no way Ron Baker was going to get this kind of an offer. Now, there was a little bit of fear, because with him being only 1 year and Arenas limited, if they had spent all their cap room, they didn't have bird rights on him, he was making the minimum last year. Also, why didn't they just sign him to a two-year deal to begin with, by the way, with the minimum exception? That's
he had so much leverage on them, Nate. He was never going to accept a two-year deal.
Yeah, he's undrafted last year. In any event, yeah, this is a pretty gross mismanagement of resources. He wasn't going to get an offer like this to get a player option on a second year as well. And then his qualifying offer would be high. If you want to make him restricted again, he's getting an automatic 25% raise. It's just really, really surprising to me. Maybe they feel like, hey, you know, we're just going to, he's going to be close to being our starter. And he showed a little bit last year. He had some nice games, but overall his statistical resume, not impressive. He's not going to be able to defend ones at a high rate. Maybe he could be an okay backup combo guard for you, but the price here, it's just, there's no way he was going to get like some big restricted free agent offer sheet. And I guess the concern again was if they were going to use cap space and they use their room exception on someone else, they wouldn't have anyone to match it because they didn't have bird rights on him. So maybe that's like, all right, we got to get him locked up right away. That was probably the thinking, but it's still, why not just let him chill out there for a while? And because no one was going to give it more than the room exception, like that was the error.
It's the weirdest form of risk aversion, because the risk is that Ron Baker is going to leave. I don't think that's a risk.
Yeah, so. we won't be able to match on him if someone pays him over the room exception. Well,
for 3 years,
you don't want him on something over the room exception,
right? But hopefully, they're going to make fewer of those kinds of mistakes. They hired Scott Perry to basically the deal it sounds like David Griffin didn't want, where he got a 5-year contract to be the Knicks general manager. He is going to be under Mills and well respected around the league. We'll see how much autonomy he actually gets, but we'll have to see.
Yeah, and of course, this was on the heels of David Griffin publicly pulling out and likely leaking that the reason he did so was because the Knicks weren't willing to want him to work under Steve Mills and weren't allowing him to bring in his own people. And that's not going to happen for Scott Perry either, by all accounts. He's just going to slide in. There's some skepticism about a culture change when many have tried and failed to do that, and all the same people have been there. Talked to a few people, by the way. I mean, there is the frustration in the organization about the Phil Jackson thing, I think, is totally understandable, especially because there was a thinking that Dennis Smith wouldn't fit in the triangle, and then we got this guy just for the triangle, and then Phil's gone, and we're not going to be running the triangle anymore. I mean, the same thing that we were saying. I mean, I think people in the organization felt that same frustration. But I mean, that was, and frankly, those talked to at least 3 organizations this summer league where people were just a little bit down about some of the whimsical decision making, the changing of courses within the organization, what that said about ownership. And it reinforced for me again just how much ownership is important and how much just being able to find a plan and stick to. I mean, that's step one, right? Is like even being able to stick to a plan. Now you got to have the right plan, and you still got to get lucky in following along with that plan. You still got to make the right evaluations. But when you can't even make a plan to begin with, and that's just so incredibly frustrating for some of the people who work in the organization.
Ownership is the greatest competitive advantage in the NBA. I firmly believe it, and we're seeing that now, and I think it's also a part of the disparity between the conferences right now. I mean, we don't know it all the way yet, but it looks like now that the Lakers are more competently run, that dichotomy is getting even more severe.
For Scott Perry, he definitely has had a lot of people who have really been in his corner. I don't know him at all. I don't know how much he had to do with precisely what happened in Orlando. He then went to the Kings. He got a lot of credit for what many people perceived as a good Kings offseason. I am less sanguine about the Kings offseason, particularly their free agent signings, particularly the signings of Randolph and Vince Carter. And their draft, I think that they did well, but it remains to be seen whether Harry Giles and Justin Jackson, in particular with that trade down from 10, I think they just, to get 15 and 20 for 10 was solid. And De'Aaron Fox had a nice summer league. I think he looks okay at 5. But to say that he like had this unbelievable job, I don't like Sacramento's summer as much. Now, Sacramento was kind enough to let him out. What's the compensation going to be eventually?
Cash considerations and a 2019 second round pick, which cannot be the Knicks' own pick because the Knicks' second round picks are owed to Philadelphia through 2021, which is amazing.
Oh, boy.
And that's separate transactions. It's one of my favorite pieces of minutia that in the NBA right now.
Also worth noting that that Sacramento and New York are prohibited from trading with one another for 1 year because that could be perceived as additional compensation. This is the Doc Rivers rule, where the Clippers couldn't obtain Kevin Garnett after trading for Doc Rivers from the Celtics, because it could be viewed as, and remember also in these transactions, you're not actually trading the executive. What you're doing is giving compensation to let the guy out of his contract, and then he signs with you. So that's basically what you're getting. And so to avoid the perception that there was more to this deal than there actually was, which you, there's no way to avoid that because you don't know like what the evaluations are in any subsequent trade that would happen in the next year. That's why that rule exists.
Right. And this is the second time it's actually happened this summer, because it happened with Jeff Weltman, if memory serves.
To those Kings, George Hill, only $40 million guaranteed on that contract. So basically, it's $17 million a year. If they front-loaded it,
which they did.
I mean, it was three for 57, yeah, which they did. So probably it's pretty close to totally non-guaranteed.
Yeah, on it's, the only last one, year. It's only $1 million. It's, I actually have the actual, I have the actual contract now, so it's, I can pull it up. It is 2019-18, and that last year is only one of the $1 million of the 18 is guaranteed, which I think really helps his trade value, depending on how the Kings wanted to handle that second year.
Yeah, and also Zach Randolph front loaded as well, so that will increase the potential trade value of these players. Again, expiring contracts may take on new life, especially when they're expiring and attached to a guy who can still play a little bit. And I'm sure the hope will be that Hill and Zebo still can, and obviously that makes that Hill deal look a lot more palatable. Let's go to the Utah Jazz now, Danny.
They reacted to Gordon Hayward's departure by adding some serious depth. So they signed Thabo Sefolosha, 2 years, $10.5 million, Jonas Jerebko, 2 years, $8.2 million, and bringing back the book club, Ekpe Udo, 2 years, $6.5 million.
Yeah, Udo starred in Turkey. Some even said he was the best player in Europe this year. Not a great scorer, but has some passing ability from the high post. The game has evolved to switch his skill or to fit his skills a little more because he can switch, protect the rim. He is 30 now at this point, and he flamed out, you'll recall, with the Clippers in his last NBA stint when we thought actually that he could help them, and then Doc kind of lost him, as he tends to lose a lot of these deep bench guys that he signs at times. So I think he can help the Jazz. He also could provide them with a little bit of insurance if he plays well. If a Derek Favors trade materializes, they won't play, you would think, Favors as much at backup center this year. And then Jerebko provides another stretch element, replacing maybe Trey Lyles and Boris Diaw, whom they had to cut. He had $7.5 million non-guaranteed, so he's going to be a free agent now. Sounds like I think he would have cleared waivers by now. And I think those are solid deals. You could maybe criticize the fact that they're both 2 years for Sefolosha and Jerebko, but one thing I really like about this Jazz team now, they are a great defense at times last year when Gobert was in, but they couldn't force any turnovers. And then they picked up Thabo Sefolosha, Donovan Mitchell, and Ricky Rubio this offseason. They're going to get a ton of steals. Like, this is going to be a nasty defense next year.
And they're going to need those stops because I worry a little bit about their offense. But
yeah, more than a little bit.
Yeah. So I was fiddling around with them actually in 2K, and I was playing, and I just realized, holy crap, they're not going to score. And but I still like a lot of the guys on this team, and Jerebko in particular. You know, there was the question when they waived Boris Diaw, which also we should mention, of kind of where they were going to go at the power forward position. And Jerebko is a worthwhile gamble there. They have Derek Favors for this year, assuming they don't trade him. And then Joe Johnson has played some at the four, but I don't think you want to do that too much in the regular season. Joe Jerebko can bring some of that floor spacing, but maybe a little more reliability in terms of minutes.
Yeah, so I think these are good. I think that some people maybe missed out on Jerebko and Thabo. I mean,
Thabo, another guy who would have made sense for Cleveland.
Yeah, I would. I mean, if you consider, because Cleveland, their luxury tax, we haven't talked about this yet, we kind of got sidetracked, but basically where they're at now, they have 13 players under contract. That includes Kay Felder and Eddie Tavares, who are both nine guaranteed but played well in summer. Osman, he cost them $15 million with his $2.6 million, which we project this year. And then that repeater tax only keeps going up. So if they're going to add one more roster spot now at the veterans minimum, which counts against the cap at $1.47 million, that's going to add another $8 million bucks to their bottom line. Every minimum contract they sign from here on out is going to cost $8 million in cash. So I would be shocked if they don't just stay at the minimum 14 players all year. They've got one more minimum slot to get there. And they actually could have just, it would have been cheaper for them to just like buy a second round pick, because when you sign your own second round pick, that counts as less against the luxury tax than if you just sign an undrafted rookie free agent. And what they're going to do now, presumably, is they'll wait until after the trade deadline when you sign into the rest of season contract, and they'll probably save, you know, $6 million by doing that.
And of course, the second round nuance is something they probably would have done if they had a GM. But
that is correct. Yeah, I mean, that's it. And you know, Kobe Altman probably realizes that, but
yeah,
still, you could.
It's hard. It's
have
a harder
more
pitch
impetus there.
Yeah. Yeah. A couple of quick bookkeeping things. Also, Mike Scott signed for the minimum in Washington. I think I actually have them at 15 guys now. I don't know if his contract, what the guarantees are on it, but he presumably will be their 15th guy. And Sergio Rodriguez will no longer be in the NBA. I thought he might be a worthwhile fit as the backup point guard for the Lakers, but he has, in my own parlance, signed with Russia. He signed with CSKA Moscow. So he will be playing there. And his contract is long. It's through 2020. So I would say he is not coming back to the NBA.
Well, and you mentioned his fit with the Lakers. I just don't think that an NBA, this is still one of those situations where he's not worth as much to an NBA team as he is to a team overseas.
That's certainly a fair point.
I'm sure they're paying him more than what the NBA minimum would, especially because they add it to be tax-free and stuff. All right, let's go out with who is still out there. Oof. In terms of remaining free agents. This is my top five unrestricted bigs. In terms of pure centers, Andrew Bogut is still out there, just in terms of the player. He's probably the best, although obviously a health risk. Mo Spates, there's some talk that he might play in Atlanta, but they now have plenty of centers. We mentioned Dante Cunningham, JaVale McGee, David Lee, Boris Diaw. Those are some of the best guys. Then we get down into really
pretty
fringy guys. Yeah, I said him.
Okay, and then Powell. But Powell, we assume he's coming back, but he is still technically right. A free agent.
Yeah, that's a good point. And then on
the
wing...
correct, the best kind of correct.
On the wing, Gerald Henderson, Tony Allen, Shabazz Muhammad, really not appearing to get it many nibbles at all. Aaron Aflalo, Matt Barnes actually played like 1800 minutes last year. Mike Dunleavy, even Ian Clark. Those are the guys that I have as guys who I thought, you know, project as rotation type of guys. Maybe Brandon Rush is out there as well. At point, Derrick Rose, obviously the biggest name free agent still remaining out there, just no traction really being reported with him. Had a second meeting with the Milwaukee Bucks, which, I mean, maybe they offered him a minimum contract in that meeting, but I can't imagine it would be any more than that considering their tax situation. Deron Williams also out there as well. It does not appear, maybe he'll be the last guy who goes back to the Cavs for the minimum. And I, if I were them, oh yeah, it's because the other guy they signed too, we were talking about all offense, was Jose Calderon, another guy who can't play against the Warriors when we were discussing their philosophies compared to
couldn't
Houston.
Couldn't play with him either.
Yeah. Ty Lawson, who played like a solid backup point guard last year, someone who might still be available. Brendan Jennings, who did not play like a solid backup point guard last year. And then, of course, we get to the restricted guys who are
oh, well,
pretty
I want to mention two more point guards.
Own. Yeah. Oh, please.
Ramon Sessions and Tyler Ennis. Ennis, I think, okay. Is
yeah, Ennis,
probably
we should have mentioned. You're right.
Yeah, and so he now cannot, the Lakers had that limited window that they maybe could have signed him because of the decline option, but now he's basically out of their reach. I guess they could use that same amount of the room exception, but I don't think we'll see it.
Yeah, they still don't have a traditional backup point guard on the roster. It would really have to be Jordan Clarkson, I guess, and maybe he'll just play as a combo guard. He can play next to Ball or next to KCP. But I think the Lakers could use one more. If they could get him back, I would absolutely take him back for that amount of money. And then they would have early bird rights on him next year.
And a reasonable cap hold, too. Yeah,
they may even have full bird rights on him, actually.
Yeah, they would. I believe they would.
Yeah, and his cap hold would be lower. So it may be a guy, I think.
Well, that's what happened with Austin Rivers. Yeah, that they would have full bird rights.
I mean, I was pleased with the increase he showed in his shooting ability and his defensive effort down the stretch as they actually won those random five straight games last season. So I think if I were a team that needed backup point guard help but was a younger team, I definitely would try to see if I could get him. He is pretty interesting. Nerlens Noel still out there, absolutely zero market really remaining for him at this point.
I guess the hope is that Brooklyn could just feel sympathy for him and throw an offer sheet, because they have, I think Brooklyn has about $15 million. That's coming.
But see, I mean, I would be very surprised if Dallas's offer were less than 15 million.
That's true.
I'd be very surprised by that. And so, no, I mean, I think he wants like 20 is what the problem is. I mean, I think if he were, you know, in the mid teens, that he probably would have been signed already.
And then the other four restricted free agents, they're all bigs of some flavor now left. Just a tough, tough group. Jermichael Green, Mason Plumlee, Nikola Mirotic, Alex Len.
Yeah, again, especially for a Bulls team that just isn't really even trying to be good this year. They've got Lauri Markkanen. If I'm Mirotic, I maybe... I think the solution here for a lot of these is, okay, we'll get you under contract for 3 years and we won't pay you that much, but maybe we'll give you a 2+1, you know, maybe that is, or a 3+1 in the case of some of the younger guys like a Len, where, okay, all right, I realize that this salary is disappointing, but you're at least going to get a raise. In the case of someone like Plumlee or Len less so, because he was a higher pick, haven't made that much in your career. Green has made like nothing in his career. So maybe Jermichael, all right, I get it. Like, there's not that much out there for you. Like, this is a disappointment to you. But if we give you a 2+1, then you can get back on the market at 29. You'll have another chance to cash in a little bit, and we'll get you for less dollars during this next couple of years. Like, that's what I hope. So you can throw the guy enough of a bone to where it's like, all right, you missed out this time, but there still will be a next time.
A point I wanted to make here is, while we're dealing with a very small sample size, big men did not get years this offseason. Some did, a couple, but like Taj Gibson, he got two. Correct?
Yeah, 2 for 28.
Two for 28. Ibaka got 3. Millsap got a 2+ a team option. Deadman 1+1. Randolph 2.
Can we call a team option like a 2-1 instead of a 2+1?
Sure. I used in my sheets, I use, or like in my parlance, I use 2T1, but yeah, we could do that.
I mean, I don't know, that's probably gonna be too confusing.
Pachulia 1 year, Ilyasova 1 year, Amir Johnson 1 year, Rebko 2 years, Baines 1 year, Muscala 1+1, David West 1. Like, this, it's pretty incredible that none of these guys got years. It's a good thing. I mean, I'm sure certain teams wish they would have done the same thing last year, but there just weren't that many. A lot of it is also a supply issue. Just the same guys were not available and the money was not available. But that is notable to me in terms of where the league is going. Yeah, some of those guys did get paid. Kelly Olynyk got money. He got 4 years. And then if you get into more guys that are more forwards than bigs like James Johnson, those guys still got paid. But legitimate centers just didn't get years. Nene got 3, but at that really cheap price.
Yeah, so is that right that the only traditional power forwards or centers who got more than 3 years is Blake Griffin and Kelly Olynyk? Yeah, I think that's right. Wow. Mirotic or Green maybe could get into that group too. But
And Nerlens.
Yeah, that's true. But he hasn't gotten it yet.
Nope. And that should be a lesson. I will be writing on this at some point in the next month. I like that now we're in the offseason, so it's not the next week, it's the next month, about the restricted market next year. But these guys need to be looking at what happened this year, and the agents and the players should just be looking with fear and real understanding in their eyes, because this is going to happen again, and it's going to be worse.
Dude, our mock rookie extension podcast is going to be very interesting. But
Feldman's
going
to make people cry.
Well, by people you mean me as the player agent,
right? Or actual agents of players who listen to that podcast.
So, in terms of teams that still have some space out there, we've talked about most of them. You mentioned Brooklyn; they got about 15. Chicago's got about 15 if they want to create it. The Lakers are done now, except for the room exception. Orlando, pretty close to done, except for the room exception. Philly's got 15, presumably earmarked for Robert Covington's renegotiation and extension. Phoenix has got under 20 now with the Allen Williams whenever he signs, but still plenty to work with. Sacramento, I think, has about 7 left. San Antonio, about done. I think they've got their BAE left and maybe to bring back Gasol. Utah is done. So yeah, not a ton of money left out there for most of these guys, and the only teams that do have it are teams that are probably going to just leave that space open.
Yeah, so then that looks really bad for the restricted free agents, and we also might see a couple guys, the restricted guys too, but like Gerald Henderson, Shabazz Muhammad, following Mba Mute's lead and just taking cheap contracts on a team that they think they can shine.
All right, that'll do it for us today. Thank you so much for listening. We apologize for the long delay. We will be on 2 days a week here, so although we'll actually do probably 2 more podcasts. Summer League Prospect Review will be coming next after this. It'll take a little while to watch all the film on that, but as soon as we get that done, we will get you a podcast. Don't forget about our Patreon as well, patreon.com/DuncanLaRue. And our merchandise. Saw actually a few Dunked On t-shirts in the Thomas & Mack Center in Las Vegas, which certainly warmed my heart. And we've got mugs available as well. That's all available at NateDuncanNBA.com. And Danny, I know you've been hard at work editing your book, so please feel free to plug the link to that again.
Yeah, so, well, before that, I want to take a second to thank everybody who took the time to come over and say kind words. And for in Vegas, wearing a name tag certainly helps, but of course doing the Twitter NBA show does as well. And it really is wonderful to get that. And while emails and everything else, certainly we appreciate that too, the in-person thing of people just being excited to see you was both surreal and appreciated. Yeah, I'm knee deep in editing the book. I'm about at page 260 right now on a full edit of the entire thing. I think there's gonna be one more after that. It's 100 things Warriors fans should know and do before they die. It is on Amazon. If for those of you who prefer smaller independent sellers, it might be available there, but it's not coming out until November 1st. So whatever makes you happy, and it's gonna be great. I'm really going through it has made me invigorated again about the project. But yeah, it's a lot of work.
All right, catch y'all next time. Till then.